Welcome to the Self-Made Mind Podcast. We'll be bringing you real-life, honest conversations with some of the world's elite performers, from sporting athletes to millionaire CEOs and everyone in between. Success leaves clues. And it's now our mission to deliver these stories so you can start writing your own self-made script.
Okay, hello everyone. It's series two, episode two. My name's Alex O'Keefe.
I'm Craig Billington.
Of course you are, mate.
Of course.
So yeah, we're here again. How are you doing, pal? How's everything going?
Yeah, you know, it's all good actually. It's lockdown's easing a little bit, so you know, we're getting to do more things and go out again, I think. Is that what we're allowed to do?
Just be humans, hopefully, yeah, soon. Yeah. Start interacting with people, that's going to be weird, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And we've had a bit of nice weather as well, so...
We certainly have, mate. We certainly have. And I hear you're back to football training tonight.
Yes, football training tonight. Just back to... Back to the
brilliant
game of football, can't we?
That's what we all want, mate, innit? That's what we all want.
Yeah.
While we've still got it in his legs. So, yeah, brilliant, mate. So, this week's episode, following on from the series opener last week with Hal Robson-Kanu, that went down really well. Had some great feedback on that one. So, yeah, we've got off to a good start, mate. This week's... I'd like to think we're keep knocking it up a notch each time, mate. We've got Richard McCann. He is actually the son of Wilmer McCann, who was the first victim of Peter Sutcliffe, otherwise known as the Yorkshire Ripper. So it's a bit of a mad story how this come about. He spoke at my school when... I think I must have been about 13, something like that. Always remember the talk. It's one of those that sticks with you for life. So he's recently just featured on a Netflix docuseries called The Ripper. Saw him on there. So yeah. Luckily he agreed to come on and have a chat with us, mate. So yeah, what did you think about it first of all? Yeah.
Yeah, we were very lucky to get him on. I remember him saying before we spoke to him that he kind of has to pick and choose who he goes on, what podcasts and interviews he does, and unfortunately he picked us, which is nice.
Definitely.
And just listening to the full story, because I'm not really into the whole serial killer thing, but a lot of people and a lot of friends that I have are into it, and they were like, can't wait for this one.
Yeah.
And it is a good one.
Yeah, certainly was, mate. It's just such an interesting subject, isn't it? Like just the whole serial killer. What Richard's been through in his life, it's not just that you'll find out in this episode. He's gone through a lot of terrible stuff, but his mindset about everything going forward is just like... Yeah, it's like bulletproof, and he's gone on to be like an international keynote speaker and does loads of corporate talks and stuff for businesses now, just all around mindset. So, you know, he's done time in prison, he's all sorts of stuff. So he's definitely walked the walk, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he's always going to be known for that one thing, mainly, which is... But it's not just him. That's not just him. Like, he does a lot of stuff. Like you say, his motivational speaking is a massive thing, and his businesses and stuff like that are going really well. And also, if you've got LinkedIn and you follow him on that, give him a little follow, because he is one funny man.
Yeah, he is, mate. Yeah, he's a character. He's a character, isn't he? Let's get this going, mate. It's Series 2, Episode 2, Richard McCann. Here we go. Okay, a massive welcome to tonight's guest. It's Richard McCann. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. I'm doing really well. It's, well, at the time of recording, it's Friday and, you know, weekends. Not that we can do a great deal at the moment, but it's still the weekend.
Yeah.
And it's all blurring into it. No, I'm doing well, my friend. It's nice to see you again after all this time.
Oh, I know. I know, it's crazy. So just to let the people know, I guess, how this come about. So you actually did a great talk in my high school. I think we were just talking before this, and I think it was about 2004. So that many years ago, you did a great like motivational speech in our school, and it left a long lasting memory on myself, mate. And then saw you recently on the Netflix documentary, and yeah, I said I just had a sudden urge to get in touch with you, mate, and try to get you on. So really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, good man. Good man. By the way, it's not as early as 2004. I didn't get my first engagement until 2005. I reckon it was a bit later that year.
Right.
You're making yourself out to be older than you are, my friend. And stay young, stay young. But it's certainly around maybe 10 years ago. I don't know how old you are. No.
28. It's longer than that, mate. I'll tell you that. Probably two. We'll go 2005 then. Yeah. So thanks for coming on, mate, first of all. And great to have you here. Let's start from the beginning, mate, if that's okay, and we take it back to your childhood, and then bring us up to the recent day in a bit of a compressed version, if you can.
Yeah, no problem. Well, I don't know how much you remember from that talk 10 years ago, but you know, the thing that got me into doing what I'm doing now and such like is what happened amazingly 45 years. Is it 46 years? It's 46 years this year. 46 years ago. Gosh. I know I don't look old enough.
You don't, man.
I'm 50. I'm 52 this year. But when I was a five-year-old boy, and many people do know this about me because I've done lots of local stuff and national stuff, and as you say, on Netflix at the moment. But I lost my mum, and that's not unusual, you know, a child. And I've met many kids that have lost parents, but I think it was the nature of, not just the nature of what happened, but it was what followed the press. In some ways, the press intrusion, but it was the fact that, I mean, before the big thing that happened, which I'll get to, but I mean, we lived a pretty poor. I mean, life was difficult anyway for us, living on a council estate with no money, and my dad was violent and the drinking. But it was that week before my sixth birthday in October 75, where mum went out drinking, and we didn't see her again, and you know. What I'll never forget till the day that I die is getting up the following morning and wandering the streets looking for my mum, you know, hoping she would come home on the first bus. When I think about it, and when I have thought about it, I always imagine myself to be like a teenager doing that, but it wasn't. I was five. It was a week before my sixth birthday. Now, when I see little 5-6-year-old children now, I think, yeah, was I really that young? But I was that young, and she never did come home. And, you know, what transpired was, well, the way that we were given the news at the children's home, which we were taken to later that day by the police, was that mum had been taken to heaven and that we weren't going to see her again. Never forget that. Never forget that disbelief. What? Never going to see my mum again. I couldn't, as a kid, I couldn't comprehend it, and I didn't want to believe it. And I remember praying for her to be brought back. And, you know, obviously she never was brought back. But that is, well, for those of the listeners that don't know, my mum was, we later discovered, was murdered by Peter Sutcliffe. Not that we knew his name, but this serial killer, which, and I'm not even going to use the phrase, I don't like to use the phrase, the Yorkshire, I'll just say the Yorkshire R. I don't like to use that term anymore. But that's who killed my mum. And because it was him, and because it became such a massive news story, it followed me around everywhere. And it just meant that, well, I felt damaged. Oh, I was damaged, actually. I felt damaged goods. I thought I was never going to achieve anything. They're all better than me and such like. So I suppose, you know, just for the listeners now, that is who I am. That's what I experienced as a child. And the reason that me and you met 10 years or whatever it was ago was because people well, once I began sharing my story and no longer making up lies about my mum and my past, because I used to make up stories, once I finally wrote my book in 2004, 17 years ago, and I really shared who I really was and what we'd really been through, it was that not only did it liberate me, but it led to me getting my first invitation to speak, which ironically was in a school, Horbury School in Wakefield, was my very first presentation. I remember doing it. It was all these teenagers, and it was tough. You know what teenagers can be like, you know, they were just kind of fascinated by the story. And then, you know, eventually that led to doing more in the West Yorkshire area, which led me to your school, whenever it was. So that's who I am. Well, that's not who I am. That's the part of my story where I get asked to speak or go on podcast or whatever. It's because of what happened when I was a child. Although you'll know from the story, from when I was in your school, that wasn't the only thing that I went through. And I don't know which direction we might be going with this interview. But, you know, for example, I was in prison 23 years ago for dealing drugs. So that was another challenge. Incidentally, there's been a number of challenges since you heard me last that I've also had to deal with, because that's what life is. Life is a series of highs and lows. It quite literally is. And we're going, you know, collectively, we're all going through a bit of a low right now. But here's one thing you won't remember the detail, but one of the things that I always like to say is it could always be worse. And that mindset or that philosophy has helped me not just deal with mum, but going to prison could have been worse. I could have got 3 or 4 years, could have been shipped down south, but they kept me in Leeds and I got a year. So it could always be worse. So I know that you knew all this, Alex, anyway, but just for the listeners, that's I guess who I am, part of who I am.
Yeah. Brilliant. Obviously. So I struggle to try kind of wrap my brains to try and remember the talk, what, you know, what you gave to us. But I just always remember just feeling just really like emotional and but also motivated at the same time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's such a powerful thing that you were doing back then and what looks like what you are doing now as well. So
do you remember the reference to the Ginger Massive? Do you remember the Ginger Massive?
No, I can't remember that. Yeah, refresh my memory on that.
Because obviously you'll remember that I did share some photograph of me as a young boy with this bright ginger hair. So I used to champion the Ginger Massive, like the Staines Massive. Ali G talks about the Staines Massive.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I'd have my three ginger children coming on going, Ginger Massive. And it was just it's just this thing that I only ever did with teenagers and not with adult audiences. But I don't do a lot with the schools anymore. I mean, I do some, but it used to be predominantly schools. And since then, it's been like, you know, corporate work. And there's other things that I do now. I do presentation skills training. I do a lot of that now, speaking to camera skills and such like, and also resilience stuff, staff satisfaction. My business has completely transformed since I only spoke in schools. But I'm glad that you remembered anyway.
Yeah.
So some of me. And maybe not the detail, of course, lots happened since, but I do remember Hippo Hub. For some reason, well, I used to have a girlfriend, you see.
Right.
When I was in prison, the reason I remember Hippo Hub and Lightcliff, she used to live in or above Hippo Hub and Lightcliff post office.
Ah, right. Okay.
There must be a Hippo Hub and Lightcliff post office. Is that right? There must be.
There will be.
And then when I came out of prison, she had a house a little bit closer to Halifax at this point. There's a big set of traffic lights, isn't there, on the way to Halifax? And she lived above a shop there as well. So I've got like a bit of an affinity with that school or that area because of my ex-girlfriend who dumped me, by the way, and I was heartbroken.
Well, that's her loss, mate. It's her loss.
Yeah, you say that. No, it was her loss. I wonder what she's doing now. Anyway, hey-ho.
Yeah. So, yeah, obviously it's such an impact. I'm just wondering, like, because you went through so much, you know, trauma when you were younger. And obviously what you do now is probably because of what you went through when you were younger. Would that be right, Richard? Would I be right in saying that?
Absolutely. I mean, if I hadn't gone, by the way, people sometimes say to me when we do Q&A, if that had not happened to you, what do you think you'd be doing? I have no idea what I'd be doing. Mm. I could be... But whatever I will be doing, whether it's washing windows, ironing trousers, washing plates in a hotel, some of the jobs that I've done, I've always tried, and it's probably because of my early life. It's because I didn't have a lot. I've always gone out there and tried to improve myself, improve my lot, improve my situation, be the best stacker of boxes, try and get promoted, be the fastest deliverer of newspapers. So if you get back first, if there's anybody that's phoned in sick, you'll get another round to do and earn a bit of extra money. So I've always been really keen, ambitious. But it'd be fair to say I would not have been speaking in schools or wherever I speak. I spoke for a big corporate organization this morning. I wouldn't be doing that had I not lost my mum. Well, mainly had I not lost my mum, but then been impacted by it in the way that I had. So, and I think a lot of us can say that. A lot of us can, when you look back over your life and you chart, I have this thing in my resilience workshop, I have a thing that's called this, it's called the bounce backer graph. And it's basically, you just draw your life, the ups and the downs. And if it's a down or a challenge or a setback or adversity, you're in the red. If things are going well, you're in the green. And what I get people to do, and if anyone's listening, you could do this in your mind or on a piece of paper if you want. We've all been through stuff. All right, younger people might have been through less, although I didn't. When I was a child, I've been through a lot of stuff, so you can never say that. But, you know, more often than not, it's not until you've had, you know, 25, 30, 40 years that you, when you look back, you say, gosh, I've been through all those things. We all go through them. And the great news is, I think it's great, if you were to do that exercise, the bounce backer graph, after every setback that I've been through, that you'll have been through, we always end up back in the green, as I call it, back in a plus. It might take you 3 years, it might take you 5 years. It might take 18 months going through a pandemic where you're earning no money, so you're in the red, but you'll get back there because it is the pattern of life. It happens every time. It doesn't happen every time, though, for some people. I'm sure I'm not the only person here or listening that's lost somebody through suicide because they haven't found a way back into the green, or they haven't believed there is a way back. I mean, there was times, you won't remember this. In fact, I probably didn't share everything to teenagers, but there's been times that I've wanted to take my life. When I came out of prison, I formed a suicide pact with my sister Sonia. I couldn't find a way back in the green. Nobody would give me a job. I've got a criminal record. I've got all that my girlfriend dumped me from hip hop. Plus I've got all that childhood. I thought, what's the point? And I was in the red and I didn't see a way out. So, you know, life's not black and white. It's not like, oh, it was tough as a childhood and you know, I came out of it. It's been up and down, and I've doubted myself. I've been suicidal. So, but I think it's a good reminder for us all and me that when stuff happens, there is a way back. Life may never be the same again. You know, I can't bring my mum back, so I can never have her back. But over time, the pain of losing mum and some other things along the way has improved. When I went to prison, I remember the shock to the system. When I went the first night I went into prison, it was like, oh my God, how am I going to get through this? This is not me. Actually, it was me. I'd created that by getting involved in drugs. But as the days and weeks passed, I started getting used to it. And, you know, and you do with challenge, with adversity. Not that they said, I know the thing's not adversity today, but it's very relevant for a lot of people right now because a lot of people are struggling. Yeah. A lot of people are struggling.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's such an important point, really. Like you say, it's, you know, you talked about there, like, you couldn't do anything about your mother passing. So I think what you're saying there is, you know, you can't control certain things, but you can control how you react to it.
Absolutely. You're right. So I can't control going to prison. I've got to go. I can't bring mum back, but I can decide how I think about that situation. Seligman, an author, calls it your explanatory style. Done a bit of research and reading. So you can decide how you explain what's going on around you. And often, we're programmed to find danger and threat. We are programmed. That's how we've stayed on the planet. But because we've got that in our system, often it can come out when we least expect it or when we don't need it, and you're finding negative things in life, and so it's hard to kind of counter that. But it takes effort, but it is possible for us all. You know, it is possible to find those silver linings in those dark clouds. It's another exercise that I do in my resilience workshop. When you tell yourself and ask yourself to find the silver lining in the last 12 months, for example, which is what I asked this corporate client this morning. I asked all the audience, what was the silver lining that's come from the last 12 months? And they were all giving the responses and they all appeared on screen. And a lot of them, it was talking about family. you know, no commuting, saving money, and such like, decorating the house. So those silver linings are there if you choose to look and focus and try and kind of pull them out of life. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. What I want to know is, so after you've gone with your mother and then you've gone to prison, like, at what point did you like just change? What changed it for you? What, you know, I need to change something here.
That light bulb.
Yeah.
There has been a number of good question. Craig, you weren't at the Hippo Home, were you?
No.
You know, so it wasn't a case of, you know, at that point I decided, Scott, I'm going to change. Mm. I think there's been different moments throughout my entire journey where I've decided, no, that's not the way to do it. That's not the way to think. Like, as a child, I was having suicidal thoughts. As a kid, I was having murderous fantasies. But there come a point where I thought, well, listen, this is not serving me. This is not the way to think and behave. And that's a silly, stupid thing. Why would you do that? So I think my whole life has been a number of different moments. Mm-hmm. And just because you have a decision at one point to say, right, I'm going to do things differently at this point, like I'm going to go to London and fresh start and join the army. That was me, you know, trying to take control of my life. So you could say that was a turning point. But then it went pear-shaped, because when I got posted out to Germany, a magazine was published about Sutcliffe. They found out. They started talking to me about it. I had a breakdown. Got kicked out of the army. So despite trying to take control, that was a turning point. But then it all went pear-shaped. Came back to Leeds. So it ebbs and flows. But I think the big change, well, there's two big changes. One was when I came out of prison and couldn't get that job, when I formed that suicide pact, because I couldn't find a way back to the green. I mean, practically, I couldn't see a way back. I'm getting my house taken from me. No girlfriend, criminal record. What is the point? I couldn't see, and often we can't see the path to get to where we want to be, wherever it may be. And it was Sonia taking the tablets the day we discussed it, which brought me to my senses and had me think, you know, even if we've got to live in a council flat, by the way, there's nothing wrong with living in council or rented accommodation. But because when I lived in a flat, I kept getting burgled. Thought, oh no, not back to that. But even if I did get burgled, I thought to myself, surely life is worth living, even if it's in a flat. So that was a turning point. So I've never, that's not true. I was going to say, I've never considered taking my life since. I have, but that was a turning point. The next big turning point was when Sonia stabbed her boyfriend in 2002. That incident, she didn't kill him, was what prompted me or motivated me to write my book. I've had enough. I'm going to write a book. They're not going to send my sister to prison and you know, lock her up, throw away the key. I could imagine them saying, "No, I'm not. I'm going to write this book. The world needs to know what we've all been through, what support we didn't get, and such like." So, and that writing of that book changed my life. The police dropped the charges, incidentally, and it liberated me, if I'm honest. And what I've since discovered, actually, writing down your stuff, not necessarily for publication like I've done, but just the act of writing down your challenges, the stuff that's gone on in the past, is a resilience tool. It's called expressive writing. You write it down for 20 minutes, 4 days in a row. And what they found, that people that did that, this big study was in America, of students, what they found was those that wrote down those challenges, as painful as they might have been when they wrote them, and it was painful for me when I wrote my book, and things came back to me I'd forgotten about. And they found that those that did that in the study, they had less visits to the student health center. So it affected their immune system. So it is, expressive writing is a resilience tool. Anyway, but that was, I think that was the biggest significant thing that I did when it all started turning around for me. I mean, I was working. So it wasn't like I was at rock bottom or anything. I was working, but it's completely changed my life. And I don't just mean financially. And by the way, I don't earn that much money. People think I'm a millionaire, and I'm absolutely not. I'm the same as everybody else. But it's changed how I see myself, and it's allowed me to come out of myself and no longer be ashamed of being ashamed of my mum, to be fair. I used to be ashamed of my mum and how she was written about and spoken about. And a lot of that was featured in the Netflix documentary.
Yeah.
And I felt that as a child. So writing the book, it was almost like I shed a skin. I thought, oh, this is who I really am, warts and all. And it was the best thing I've ever done, apart from my children, of course.
Yeah.
And so that was another turning point. But I must go back to what I said. I have felt suicidal since that first, wasn't it, that suicide pact, which was 1997, 23, 24 years ago. When my sister Sonia in 2007 took her life and killed herself, that, I mean, she was my soulmate. She, I mean, I had other sisters, but we were the, it was me, for the start, we were the two eldest. So we went looking for mum. So that was something that connected us. And that sitting at that bus stop, it was just our bond. So when she took her life, I have to tell you, I fleetingly thought, I can't live without her. I genuinely thought that. I remember laying on the bed thinking, she's been around for, 39 years in my life. And I thought, I cannot live without her. But then reality kicked in. I'd just had my second child, Ellis, and I thought, what a stupid thing to think. And I just had to experience the pain, and I'll get through it because I know I can eventually.
Yeah, that's obviously it's very, you know, thanks for sharing that. First of all, it's quite a, you know, can be quite a difficult thing to speak about. But yeah, it's credit to you, Richard, that, you know, you are where you are now. What you've gone through, it's just inspirational just seeing where you are now, to be honest.
Yeah. And the great news is I'm nobody special. I don't have any special powers. I'm just a guy. So, yeah. You know, I don't really like to be thought of as you know, somebody. I'm just like you, Alex and Craig. You know, we're just people out when we've got choices and we've got struggles and we've got depressions and dark days and we've got all that stuff. And all I try and do is, you know, do my best to get through that day to the next day. And sometimes I've made mistakes, and we all make mistakes, like the prison.
I think one thing that stands out is, like you were saying there, when you chose to write your life experiences down.
Yeah.
I think that kind of, it brings a different level of like authenticity to everything in your life. And that's a great way to live. And I think that's what I certainly can relate to you on that side, that you just seem like a real honest guy, you know what I mean? So, and that's the best way to be. And that's what people buy into as well.
Yeah. And lots of people do wear, I mean, I know we all to some degree wear masks, but you're right. I wasn't being true to who I was up until writing the book. I wasn't being authentic, as you say. And people do it. People go in the workplace and they put all these, this persona that's not really them. One of the best things you can do is to be authentic. And by the way, when I first started speaking, I imagined that if you're a speaker, you've got to be like politician-like and, you know, and I genuinely thought that's what I needed to do and be really posh sounding, and absolutely incorrect. I mean, I am a rough diamond. I've got no qualifications. And all that stuff, prison, and best thing I've ever done. I used to fear at work when I came out of prison. That they're going to find out. And I'd get, sometimes my boss would say to me, "Can you come into my office for a few minutes?" And I'd go into the toilets, splashing water over my face, thinking, "Oh my God, he's found out." So in writing that book, I don't have to do that anymore. It's just like this is who I am.
Yeah. It's a great feeling. It is a great feeling. I feel like I can relate to that. I feel like just honesty and integrity and everything. You are who you are. And if people don't like it, then, you know, off you pop.
Yeah, you and also, and you can do your best to be, you know, who you are, Watson and all the rest of it. But some people are not going to get you. People are just not going to get you. And I've learned that, and we have to learn, I think, to not take that personally. Yeah. So I mean, I've coached over probably 7,000 people now to do presentations authentically, as you say, and I'll get growing testimonials. But recently, somebody, so I'm not even going to give any clues to who this person is, but wrote to me and says, "I just don't like your style. I don't gel with you. We're not going to get on." And I'm thinking, oh wow, how? And I, years ago, I would have thought, oh no, what have I done? I've done nothing. I'm being myself. And this person, obviously their explanatory style is in a certain way. And we can't do anything about that. And so we can't change, we can try and change the world in some ways, but we can't change everybody, and not everybody's going to get us. And by the way, another thing I've learned in business is not everybody is going to want you to succeed. Oh, not everybody is going to want you to succeed. So, you know, I think in the UK, it's like what I just said. I don't want to be looked up at and seen as somebody special, and I'm not, by the way. But that's a British thing. We don't really want to celebrate our successes, do we? And then when you do say something that you've achieved, and you know, you get people bringing you down or trying to find fault. And so people are so interesting, fascinating. But I've learned not to take it personally. You know, what they think, you can't. Yeah. What did somebody once say? Somebody else's opinion of you is none of your business. I can't remember who said that, but somebody said that. Mm-hmm. So other people's opinion of you is not your business.
That's another one I've heard recently is, if you wouldn't go to someone for advice, then don't take on their opinion. Don't let their opinion affect you.
Absolutely.
That was quite an interesting one as well. So.
Like it.
Getting all philosophical, aren't we?
Yeah, well, that's good. It's good.
That's good. That's what we're here for. I want to ask you, Richard. I hope it doesn't come across as a difficult question, but I read a book recently, and it was from a lady who's actually an Auschwitz survivor, and she actually lived through, obviously, the concentration camps, and she saw her mum and dad get walked to the gas chambers, and she's gone on to become like a doctor of psychology and all sorts. She's called Dr. Edith Egar, really interesting lady. And she talks about the art of forgiveness. And she said the Nazis were still in her mind, sort of thing, controlling her years on. And then she learned that as soon as she could let that go in the way of forgiveness, that's when she felt liberated. So I'm just kind of thinking, I'm just going to ask you, have you been able to find forgiveness?
It's an interesting
in your life.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's one that's changed and evolved over the years. First of all, my father, who I haven't had a chance to go into the detail here, but he was brutal. For example, when we were reunited with him, he drowned the dog. He actually killed the dog in the bath. So that was horrible, but we all were beaten by my father, including my stepmom, and sometimes really horrific beatings. So I always carried that anger for my father, and even as a young adult, when I joined the army, I came home for Christmas home leave, and or was it in the new year? Anyway, I'd go see my dad, but there was always that anger, resentment for my father. And even in my first book, which I've got here, it even says in the acknowledgements, I've forgiven my father for what he did, but the truth is, I didn't. Right. Because there'd be something on TV, I don't know, there'd be a father and son or a family, and I'd be like, oh, my dad was never like that. And what I've learned now is that when you, she says it, Edith, what was her surname?
Edith Egar.
Egar, because I need to look into that. Yes. Holding on to that anger, the person that feels it is you, simple as that. And so I let go of, tragically, it took Sonia, my sister, to kill herself, and for me to be given the responsibility to go to him, to tell him that his first child had taken her life, and to see him crumble in the way that he did. That is how I found forgiveness for him. And in fact, on the subject of forgiveness, I asked him to forgive me, because I wrote the book. When I wrote the book, I didn't have a healthy, positive relationship with him, so there was a bit of resentment. So I felt as though, yeah, I'm going to write what he pushed through. But I regretted it afterwards. I regretted
painting him in a bad light.
I regret it. I don't know if I would have done it. I mean, if it had been a great dad, maybe I wouldn't have wrote it. Anyway, the point is, I forgave him, asked him for his forgiveness, and he gave it to me. And I had him back in my life then. So that's my first bit of forgiveness. And that introduced me to the good that it can do. But and I did start work around 2000 and when the book came out, 2005 or five or six, seven, I started working in prisons for an organization called the Forgiveness Project.
Right.
Not because, you know, to work for them, you've got to forgive. No, what they do is they go into prisons and they have somebody with a story that where there's a question, forgiveness, can you, should you, would you, do you, comes up. So I would share my story in prisons and then I'd give my opinion on forgiveness. I'm talking about Sutcliffe now, which was, there's no way I can forgive the murderer of my mum. But in 2010, I was invited by the Forgiveness Project to London, June 2010. And it was Archbishop Desmond Tutu who gave this incredible lecture about forgiveness, about, I don't know if you're aware of what took place in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation hearings. So they had these public hearings where the perpetrators of the war crimes were brought in front of the families and the public, and they had to, I guess, answer questions so they could like put it all behind them and move on in a positive way. Well, he was sharing this seminar, and I'm sat in the front, three rows from the front, on my own, just went down there, incidentally, with my tooth out, and my central tooth on the left had fallen out the day before. So I went to London with my tooth. It was horrible, honestly, like a thug that had been fighting in a bar. But anyway, I went and I listened to him. It blew me away. And the words that got to me were at the end when he was describing this scene where, you know, in South Africa, where this officer turned to the public and said, "Yes, it was me. I gave the orders." There was silence. And then he said, "Please forgive me." And somebody started clapping, then somebody else, and somebody else. And before they knew it, the whole audience were applauding these men. I guess they were saying, weren't they, that they'd forgiven them. And the final words were, and I wasn't on the edge of my seat, I was in tears. The final words from him were, "You can't force a person to forgive another, but when it occurs, it has the capacity to change a situation." And I heard those words and I thought, yeah, I can't bring my mum back, but maybe I could forgive him and change the situation. The only thing that could be, I said it earlier, your explanatory style, the only thing that can change is how I think about what took place in relation to him. That's the only thing that can change now in regards to mum. And we were all told to stay where we were. There's 500 people in this hall. This limousine was outside. We just had to applaud him as he got off the stage and he went down and he went outside. I got out of my chair and I chased out after him. He'd not even got to his limousine. I said, "Excuse me." And he turns around and he goes, "Yes." I said, "You don't know what you've just done." I said, "You've just helped me forgive the man that murdered my mum." I didn't have time for the story and who it was or anything. And he just looked at me. This is Archbishop Desmond Tutu, threw his arms around me and just hugged me. Didn't say anything. And then he finished and he said, "Thank you." Got in his car. Off he went. I didn't even go back inside. I came home. I let go of that anger that day for Sutcliffe. Don't get me wrong. And he never got any cards from me. I didn't, you know, get Christmas cards or anything, but I let go of the anger that day. And what was really great about that. So, you know, like, so in more recent years, like when he died a few months ago, some people were expecting me, the media, like, "How are you feeling?" and celebrate it. I wasn't celebrating. Yeah. He's passed away. And what was really nice about this part of my journey, the forgiveness, is a few years ago I was speaking for West Yorkshire Police. And I told my children that I'd forgiven him. And my son turned around to me. He said, "Dad, do you know, I don't know where this came from." No, I said, "I'm speaking for West Yorkshire Police tomorrow." What does that mean? He didn't understand that there's 42 different police forces. He thought she was like the police, like there's one police force, there isn't. So I said, "No, it was West Yorkshire Police that were looking for mum's killer." And he went, "Do you know what, Dad?" He says, "I think I've forgiven him as well." He's a little boy, 8-year-old. I went, "Whoa, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, he probably had a bad childhood. His mum might have been murdered." I mean, his mum wasn't murdered, but for my son to have that awareness, that emotional awareness and that capacity to say that, that was like beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And my youngest child, Isla, which is 10 now, but about, so we have these conversations, this philosophical conversations about life and forgiveness and everything. And I taught them that when you're angry, you're the one that feels it, not the other person. So we had some new neighbors move in opposite corner. We're on the corner, opposite corner, and they were in the garden. I heard later, And two of the children in the other family were fighting. And Isla turned around to one of them and said, do you know that you're angry? She says, do you know who's feeling it? You are. And it was like, oh my God, she understands. And then, and actually, she did say that, but from time to time when they're getting angry at the moment about homework and such like and schoolwork, and do you know, and when she's kicking off, I said, do you know who's getting, who's feeling the anger? Shut up, Dad. And, but it's a really, but it is a really great, but it is a life, I'm gonna skill, it is a life skill to understand, or an awareness to understand that holding on to anger, you feel it. So I let it go that day in 2010, which I think is one of the reasons that when Sutcliffe died, I was able to pick up the phone and ring his brother and offer my condolences. And this is Carl Sutcliffe. The reason I did that, he wrote to me through Facebook. He found me on Facebook and contacted me after he read my book. And just to say how sorry he was that his brother had put us all through that. And it wasn't all down to Sutcliffe. You know, my dad had his part to play as well. So I never forgot that. So I had been in touch with him from time to time over the years, got his phone number. And when he died, I felt like just offering him my condolences. One, because I wanted to, but I think also that I wanted to show the world what's possible.
You know,
because it is possible. And if somebody else can, or even just my children, if somebody else can have that approach to life, any of those positive things that can happen because of, in some ways, because of what happened to my mum, Wilma McCann, well, it means that her death wasn't in vain. So, you know, I guess why I did that, why I'm speaking about it now, because I want people to know what is possible.
Yeah, that's amazing. Just the fact that your 8-year-old son come out with that as well at that such a young age, I think it's a testament to the way you're teaching him as well. I think all of our children should be, you know, aware of stuff like that at that age, but unfortunately not, are they?
No.
But, yeah, it's such a powerful thing. I think what it is, the art of forgiveness is, I think it's taking back control and ownership of yourself and like taking responsibility almost, even if it's not your fault, you can still take control of the situation by the way you choose to think about it.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it took me a long time to learn that, of course, but I think that worked with the Forgiveness Project in those early years of my speaking career. I was introduced to other people that had found forgiveness. So I was constantly reminded, for example, it was one of the Fred West victims, Fred and Rosemary West victims. I met her sister and she'd found forgiveness for them, for killing her sister. And so I was, and other stories as well. And so I was, for a few years, I was introduced to this concept of forgiving horrendous crimes. And so, but I'd never felt courageous enough to do it. But because it was Archbishop Desmond Tutu that was sharing this message of forgiveness, I felt, you know what, surely nobody can, you know, challenge me about that, because I felt that some people might challenge me for what he did. But I'm glad I did, because it means I can forgive lesser things, can't I? I can let people cut me up in the road, I can just let it go. You know, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
I was going to say something there about my son. You mentioned how powerful it was that he'd forgiven. You won't know this because it's happened since you saw me at your school all those years ago, but an incredible and uplifting, positive thing about my son was in year 3, aged 8, he was asked what does he want to do when he was older by his teachers. And I didn't know this because I went to parents' evening and there was a Polaroid picture on the wall with each child was saying, like a whiteboard saying, when I grow up, I want to be a teacher. When I grow up, I want to be a window cleaner or whatever. And my son said, when I grow up, I want to be a motivational speaker. And I went, oh, wow. But he told me that the teacher laughed at him. It was a teaching assistant. I don't think she laughed at him like we may think he meant, but that was his interpretation. She laughed at me. Maybe she thought it was sweet. Anyway, my son did start that speaker journey, culminating in him speaking in front of 3,000 people at the Echo Arena in Liverpool. He did the Leeds Arena as well for 1,500 teachers. That was a really powerful one because he was showing teachers what a child is capable of if they get the right words of encouragement. And it's beautiful. So I'm usually inspired. So I always, so my recent presentations always finish with Ellis stealing the show and finishing his presentation. It's actually available online, you know, ellismccann.co.uk. People can watch that. It's usually powerful. And but talking of entrepreneurship and stepping up, and my daughter, Isla, turned around to me in the pandemic, age 10. She said, "Dad, I want to set up my own business." This is a 10-year-old. Right? Really? She'd been inspired by the TikTokers that are out there doing stuff. So she ended up starting selling lip balms. So I went, oh, okay. Then so I'd buy a load from China, and then we'd sell like boxes of 100. Then she'll sell them up five at a time, and she made a few £100. But now her and her brother are doing it, and they're now making homemade natural lip balms, and they do ginger flavor. They do peppermint, and islasgifts.co.uk. I mean, it's really, really great to see, because when I was a child, I used to think that people in business were like this other species, and actually, we're all made of the same stuff. It's just the only thing that's different is our journey, and obviously the journey you've been on can affect how you think, and but that can be rectified when you get the right encouragement. Yeah. Gosh,
yeah,
that's fantastic, isn't it?
Have you going back to this is a little part of like my life and my journey, but have you ever said thank you to your father? Like, and when I say that is because as I grew up, my mom and dad worked together, and my father lived in a different country. I have two young kids. Have you ever said, thank you, Dad, you have taught me to be a dad? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I haven't.
Because you talk about your kids and incredibly pride, and they're proud about your children and stuff like that. And you talk about your father, and it's like, well, you think about it, your dad has taught you to be who you are as a dad in a way. Yeah.
Yep.
And I've had this conversation with my father, and it's like, you taught me so much without even teaching me. That makes sense. And it's like, well, just the way you talk about your kids, it's amazing. Like, it's, you know, I think about my kids now and I'm just like, wow, it's just brilliant.
You know what? It's a really important thing and point to make and question to ask. Regrettably, tragically, my dad passed away. 2013, he just moved into his new granny flat, and he'd not even unpacked his bags, and he'd got pneumonia, laid down on the sofa, and just was found dead. I had to go empty the flat, so I never did say thank you to my dad, but I did forgive him, and he's not here for me to thank him, but I do believe that he'll be watching, because I've got some spiritual beliefs. So thank you, Dad. You know, I do appreciate some of the things, as part of my personality is come from my father. I do some crazy things. Like yesterday, I was on LinkedIn in my underpants. 2 days ago now. And that's the kind of thing my dad would have done, to be fair. I won't say what context that was, but I will say, my daughter sent me this picture of some jeans, have the crotch cut out. She said, Dad, can I have these? Mum said I can't have them, but will you let me have them? And I stormed up and said, there's no way at 14 you were going to be wearing them. So then I got a pair of my jeans and I cut out the crotch and I put these jeans on and I took a picture. I said, unless, of course, you come to Tesco with me tomorrow with me dressed like this. And so that's why that picture was on LinkedIn. Then what I found out afterwards is my wife, Helen, she'd seen this picture, sent it to Sky, my daughter, and said, send that to your dad and tell him that you want to buy a pair of these. They were winding me up. And it was interesting. It was interesting. Yeah. I am a proud dad, by the way.
Yeah.
I've got you on LinkedIn, and you're a bit of a prankster, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what you're looking at, but I do a lot on LinkedIn. I mean, not that we're really here to talk about business, but what I've found on LinkedIn, going back to being authentic, what I am on LinkedIn is I'm authentic. You get them all there with the business suits on, I've been uber professional. That's how I thought you needed to be, like giving a presentation from notes, being politician. Like, no, just be yourself. So I'm a bit of a quirky character because of my dad being a bit of a quirky character, even though he was violent. So I put all sorts of stuff on there. It's changed my business. Absolutely game changing. I went 3,500 followers 4 years ago. I've now got 36,000 followers. Not that I'm like proud of that. The fact is, I've got so many followers because I put quirky, different stuff on LinkedIn. So I put, if I'm struggling with my daughter's homework, I'll put it on there. If someone says, Dad, can I have these jeans with the crotch cut out? And if it's going on in my world, I put it on LinkedIn and people seem to love it all. So,
yeah. I've seen quite a few. I've got to admit, I love them. To be fair,
yeah.
The one where you were DJing.
That's a recent one.
Yeah, so, I've been watching them recently. Yeah.
Once again, that was my only daughter. She was inspired by another TikToker. There's lots of people doing like mashups and stuff on TikTok. She said, "Dad, can I get one of these?" So I got her one, and I absolutely loved it. And we've been having raves in the office. We've got smoke machine, we've got lasers, we've got it all. Since I got it, my daughter's not even using it. It's like it's gone to me. And now I was looking at buying myself a bigger version, like £250 version of it with the. I'm loving that. Put it on LinkedIn, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
You gotta have fun.
Of course you have, yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Especially now, especially going through this pandemic. One of the things that I going back to my resilience tools, one of the things we can do when going through challenges is create positive events, create things that are going to give you joy, like a rave in your office or in the basement at home. When my the most challenging thing I've been through in more recent years is losing my younger sister, Angela. She died of cancer 2 years ago. When we got that news, the day that we got the news, I went home and it's a crazy thing, but I needed to feel a bit of joy. I went on and I bought Sky Sports, so I could watch some of the Leeds matches. Not that they were having many on there, but they were. So I needed some joy. So one of the things we can do when going through challenges, we can create positive events or occurrences, like getting a DJ machine or whatever it may be. Because we need to. We don't need to. We can, and it's in our interest to do that. Just in the same way that it's in my interest to be an enthusiastic stacker of boxes so I might get promoted. And it's in my interest to let go of my anger with Sutcliffe. It's just in my interest. It makes sense to let it go.
Create a better version of you.
Absolutely.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, it is.
It's been a fantastic chat, mate. I do thank you for giving us your time. We've just got a few kind of trademark questions that we end on. So we'll just
go on.
Fire them at you. So can you tell us a fact about you that most people won't know, which I'm guessing it might be a difficult one, this one, seeing as though you're authentic.
Well, I there's another one I could give you, but I'm not going to give you that one. I'm going to give you one that I put on LinkedIn a few weeks ago. You might know it. When I came out of prison, in that period of trying to get a job to save my house being repossessed, I couldn't get a job. There was a job in the paper or whatever. I can't remember where I saw it. And it was for a male stripper. And I was desperate, so I went to apply to be to join a male. You know what do they call them? Like dream boys, like a dance troupe, a stripper troupe. I don't know the correct terminology. So I went for this interview at the Hyde Park Cinema in Leeds on my own. I went there. There was two guys there, two strapping guys. They sat down in the seats and they got me on stage and said, "Right, go on then, dance in my boxer shorts." I had to dance in my boxer shorts to some house music or whatever. It was the most excruciating, painful, embarrassing thing ever. And they said, "Richard, you can move, but you ain't quite got the body we're looking for." So I had to leave with me, quite literally, with my tail between my legs. Oh, no problem. Sometimes you got to do stuff like that. Anyway, I got a job in the end, as you know. And so that's the one that I would share with you. Not many people know.
Ah, oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. Is that what you put on LinkedIn then?
I did.
Picture, in your pants.
There is another one, which I'm not going to share. I might put on LinkedIn one day.
Yeah. All right, yeah. We'll save it for LinkedIn.
Save it.
Because nobody knows it. I think there's two people on the planet that know this one. Oh, shall I tell you?
No, come on. This is an exclusive for the podcast. Come on.
No, do you know what? It's so... I'm not going to...
Just let it go. Come on.
I'll tell you a different one. It's in the same arena, ballpark arena, as in a bit dodgy. No, when I was on... I got involved in salsa. When I went through this transformation and changing my circle of friends. So I went to these salsa holidays to Spain. Brilliant holidays, by the way. Mm. And there was a talent competition and there's four or five guys that were doing a full Monty routine and they needed another person. So they asked me to do it. So I did this full Monty routine at this salsa holiday on stage and it's on YouTube. But I'm not going to tell you what to search for because you might find it. So that's another one of those things that not many people know. And I might put that on LinkedIn one day.
Yeah, go on. That'll be great.
That'd be good.
We'll be on to YouTube after this anyway.
You won't know what to find. You won't know to, you might find it. Anyway.
Robert Carlyle lookalike in Spain. Next one then, Bill.
If you could invite anybody into this chat right now, who would it be and why?
Well, I think...
past or present, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's an easy one for me, and it would be my mum, you know. Just because... because I lost her, and the memories of that I've got of my mum are very few and far between. And I don't even remember what she sounds like. So the second would be Sonia, but I know Sonia and we're 39 years together. I only had five, nearly 6 years with my mum. So if I was going to invite somebody, it would be my mum. And if that was possible, that would be mind blowing, but incredible. But not that we're going to dip into spirituality, but I do believe that mum and Sonia and the spirit of our loved ones are around us. And I've had some absolute miracles happen in my life, which I won't go into now, but mind-blowing things that are beyond explanation in the traditional sense, because my explanation is that is my mum there doing that, making that happen. I was on a webinar on one occasion, sat in this very chair talking about some of these spiritual things. And I talked about a book that I bought after Sonia died, looking for some comfort. And as I said on this webinar, I looked for the book and I couldn't find it. I went, oh, I couldn't find it. It's a book about angels. As I say the word angels around my head, there's this big, about 12 inch thick beam of light around my head that's spinning round and I can't even see it. But those on the webinar said, what's that around your head? I went, well, I can't see anything. But when I replayed it, and it appears at the moment that I say angels, a book about angels, mind blowing. So I do believe that our loved ones are around us and they can, you know, communicate with us in some ways.
Yeah.
Probably lost half the audience now.
No. I'm the same, mate, but that's another kind of conversation, really, isn't it? But
yeah,
there is. I can feel it sometimes too. Rich, just on a, you know, just to end on a really nice high note, and what kind of advice, final piece of advice would you give to someone that's maybe, you know, looking at starting a new career or, you know, taking control of their own future, basically? What advice would you have for someone?
Okay. A couple of things spring to mind, and that is do something that you enjoy for a start. You know, I do appreciate that some jobs can be really difficult, but you need to enjoy what you do. And if you can find a career that doesn't feel like work, what I've been doing for the last 15 years, 16 years, although I take it seriously and I'm really busy, and sometimes it takes me all weekend to plan a presentation. Even so, it doesn't feel like work to me. This does not feel like work. So if you can get to a place where you're doing something that doesn't feel like work, that'd be a great place to be. But when considering what things you might want to do, please don't go through life like I did, thinking that people that do whatever, this, that, or the other, are like a special species. And listen, here's how I look at things. If it's possible for somebody to do that career or do that role or write a book or become a speaker or become a musician or a YouTuber or whatever it may be, if it's been done by somebody else, you can do it. It might take you longer. And all you've got to do is study those people that have done what you want to do. How did they do it? Where did they get the inspiration from? Where did they learn the lessons? What training did they have? You know, when you can, there's nothing, it's called modeling, isn't it? You model successful people. You find somebody else that does what you want to do and you do what they did. And that's exactly what I did. With the book writing, there was a book out at the time called A Child Called It by Dave Peltzer. I thought, listen, he's got a story. Mine's like equally as powerful. So there's a desire for these kind of books. And when I became a speaker, or when I considered becoming a speaker, I was blown away by a guy called W. Mitchell, an American speaker. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. Because I was at university studying as a mature student. I thought, he's made a career out of sharing his story. I just need some help. Right. Okay. And I studied his presentation and I got his training and I went on training and got coached and all the rest of it. So I guess those are a couple of things that I would think about. Do something that you enjoy that doesn't feel like work and find out who's doing it, who's doing it well, and just model them or copy off them. Not that you can do it in exams.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Yeah. I think what you were saying there is it explains what we're doing on the podcast as well. It's like we're providing, you know, someone as a model for you to listen to, and where that's the information that we're providing. You know, someone might listen to this and think, oh, I want to be a motivational speaker. And from listening to you, you know, in this chat, it's, you know, potentially going to go on and help change someone's life. So that's why we're doing it. And yeah, perfect way to end it, mate. And
absolutely.
Been a pleasure, pal. Thank you very much.
Same here. Lovely to see you again. I'll see you in another 10 years' time. And, no, real pleasure, guys. Keep up the good work. And thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Thank you. Brilliant, mate. Take care, pal. Speak to you soon.
I'll sign off. Take care. Bye-bye.
We just want to give a big shout out to our sponsor, the Turmeric Co. Myself and Bill have been taking the shots for a while now. Take them daily with some of the the benefits. Anti-inflammatory, antioxidant. You get a proper energy boost when you have the little beauty shot. It's also shown to improve symptoms of depression and arthritis. There's loads of good stuff from these little shots. So my favourite flavour is the raw turmeric and ginger. How about yours, Bill?
It'd have to be the beetroot and turmeric. The ginger one's a little bit too spicy.
Okay, mate. Each to their own, pal. Each to their own. Very good. Head over to the show notes. And there's going to be a link in there where you can get 10% discount at the checkout just using our code TSFM10, which will get you 10% off. So crack on.
Thanks for listening to another inspiring self-made story. And we hope you enjoyed the show. We would be very grateful if you could kindly leave us a review, as it will help us impact a wider audience. You can do this on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. If you want to reach out on the socials, find us across all platforms using at the Self-Made Minds Podcast. See you next time, and happy success making.